Welcome, folks. It's indeed my privilege again to have a conversation with a Jamaican who's making a positive difference. This week, it's my privilege to speak with Miss Beverly East. She's lived in North Oregon in handwriting and practiced science of forensic document examination for over 20 years. She holds a communication degree and a master's in graphology. She was honored Woman of Achievement Award by Flory Robots Cosmetic Company in 2002 as the only woman of color worldwide disciplined and qualified in both areas of handwriting expertise. Ms. East has worked in the private and public sectors on personal management for over 14 years for both U.S. and British companies. She has established her own company, Strokes and Slant, here in Washington, D.C. since 1989. She also have offices in London, England, and in Jamaica, and where she consults with major companies worldwide. Ms. East is the author of a best-selling book, Finding Mr. Right, A New Slant for Selecting the Right and the Perfect Mate. USA Today listed it as the best summer read. Ms. East is an international speaker and has been the guest speaker at the House of Commons in London, the World Bank, and several embassies and conferences around the globe. She has been a frequent guest on major television networks such as Good Morning America, Later Today, MSNBC homepage, and BBC. She has been interviewed by the Washington Post, HR Magazine, Gold Digest, and other print media. Her opinion has been requested by the media and on landmark cases such as the Monica Lewinsky, John Bennett Ramsey, the anthrax letters of the D.C. sniper handwriting. In 2006, she won a will and testament case in the Supreme Court in Kingston, Jamaica, and in 2009 in the High Court of Trinidad and Tobago. For 6 years, she wrote a popular weekly career column, Rightly Yours, for the Sunday Gleaner, and for the past 9 years, continues to write Regarding Your Rights for the Sunday Herald. She's a contributor to two anthologies, Journey to a Blissful Life and The Journey of My Brother's Soul. While researching and writing her debut novel, she hosted popular radio shows, Living True, Tell Me About It, and Frank and Up in Front, and Upfront. Miss East founded the Writer's Lounge, an online writing course for inspiring authors. She completed her first novel of the 1957 Kendall train crash, Reapers of Soul, which was released on the 50th anniversary on September 1st, 2007. Reapers of the Soul was read at the Calabash International Literary Festival in 2008. Reapers of Soul was nominated for the Orange Prize in Paris and has been chosen for numerous book clubs around the world. Welcome to our call today, Ms. East.
Thank you for having me.
It's great. Well, let's get started and give folks a sense of your Jamaican heritage. Where do you hail from in Jamaica and your roots there?
Well, I'd like to say somewhere special like St. Elizabeth, but I was actually born in the Kingston KPH Hospital.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm actually a Kingstonian.
Okay.
I was born in Kingston. Both my parents are Jamaican, and I went to live in England when I was four.
Wow.
Yes, I joined my mother, my sister, and my father, who had already left. My mother left me in Jamaica when I was 18 months, and I never saw her again till I was four.
Wow. I know that experience.
Yeah.
So you're definitely an international citizen.
Definitely.
Give us a sense of your globe-trotting life here.
Well, I lived most of my life in London, but while I was being educated in London, I did a one-year exchange in Germany. While I lived in London, I traveled to Japan, the Middle East, most of Europe, and a couple of times to America. And then I moved to America in 1987. And I married an American, so that's the reason why I'm now living in America.
Okay. In our audience, we have high school and college kids who are always curious about career paths of our speakers. You're probably the first person who's majored in handwriting, who's such an authority in handwriting they've ever heard of. Could you describe what's involved in this career option?
Well, first of all, my career option, I think it's a career that found me rather than I find in it. I was actually working as a headhunter when I worked for a company that used handwriting analysis as a way of a selection process. You know, like nowadays people use Myers-Briggs. So I studied for 4 years and did my master's in graphology. And then I went on to study forensic document examination and learned how to look at documents that are forged. So anybody that wants to come into this career, they would first of all need to have already a degree of some subject or the other, either psychology or something else. And then you could study graphology or forensic document examination. Or you could join the police force, the FBI, and work from that. But because for me it was a second career, I already had so much work experience behind me that I was able to go straight into it. But if you were coming straight from school, you would have to have a degree first.
Wonderful. So, yeah. All right, that's a great career path you've taken.
You're
a major thought leader and communicator. You've spoken in the House of Commons. You've lectured in leading corporations. How did you go about developing such a career, craft such a career path for yourself?
Well, I think part of it is just networking and being sociable when you're out so that people, first of all, know who you are and get to know you and get to invite you to speak. I mean, you can't ask somebody, can I speak at the House of Commons? You can't call Diane Abbott or one of the ministers there and ask them if you can speak there. You have to be invited there. You have to be invited there. And so in order to be invited there, you have to make yourself sociable. You have to make yourself visible. And so that's what I did. And also because I lived in London, I would go to events, cocktail parties, support other business women, support other organizations, but making myself always very visible. And I tell people all the time, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Who do you know? That's so correct.
Yes, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Because I know that you've seen me before several times at the embassy and other Jamaican events, and I've seen you several times.
That's correct.
But it's just making that connection all the time. And I always tell people, you never know when you meet somebody what they can or cannot do for you or what you cannot and cannot do for them. So it's never to just assume that this person is wasting my time by talking to me or not being available to that person.
So it's the network.
It's networking. I do a seminar actually called The Art of Networking, and I tell people all the steps that they need to take in order to get to. In fact, I'm actually doing this topic on the 7th of October here in D.C.
Wonderful. So, maybe if you can give me that information at the end, we'll also put it out that folks who are local to D.C. can certainly avail themselves of such a great resource.
Yeah, because basically I really think my company, which I'm happy to say is 20 years old this year, it's built on networking, on meeting people, getting people to, you know, people don't wake up and say, oh, they want a handwriting analysis. People don't wake up wanting that. It's not like bread. It's not like, you know, groceries, you know. But what happens is that somebody meets me, they get an analyze, they tell somebody else, that person tells somebody else. I mean, the court case that I won in Trinidad,
right?
The person who referred that lawyer to me, to this day I've never met her.
Oh, wow.
I've never met this person. She told somebody about me, and they used me for the case, and I won the case.
Amen.
Yeah. So it's all about networking, it's about visibility, and it's about really always being nice to people when you meet them, because people won't use you if they don't think that you are a nice person or a sociable person.
Okay.
If you appear to be standoffish and, you know, you turn people away from you.
Folks, you're getting some million-dollar career advice right now if you don't appreciate that. Look at some of your work. You've written several books. You've written Finding Mr. Right, A Guide to Selecting the Mate. But today we're going to focus on your first novel, Reapers of Soul, that captured the tragedy of the Kendall train crash in 1957. First, this is a very personal work, as 14, if I recall right, of your family members were affected by this event. Tell us about your family connection in this event.
My family connection, it's my father's family. My father's family belonged to the St. Annie's Church in Kingston.
Okay.
The St. Annie's Church was organizing a trip, an outing from Kingston to Montego Bay.
Okay.
The train crashed on the return leg from Montego Bay back to Kingston in a rural area of Kendall. On the train, my father's family was on the train. 15 members were on the train. 14 of them died. Only one survived.
Wow.
And so I wanted to recreate, and it was his direct family. It wasn't like distant cousins. It was his mother, father, aunts, uncles, cousins, you know, his direct family. He had already moved to England, you know, joined my mother and was living in England when the accident happened. No whole parts of my father's family were ever brought back to Kingston to be buried.
Wow.
And I think growing up with my dad and my mother, they were very protective since this happened. And I never knew anything about it, about Kendall. And I lived in the house with this man. And he never spoke of it. He never spoke of it. And I was 18 when a cousin came to stay with me. And I was told by my cousin what happened.
Wow.
And so at first I wasn't trying to write a book. I wasn't trying to write a book at all. I was just trying to get a sense of what happened. I was like the investigator because no one would talk about it. So I would go to the library and research. And every time I went to Jamaica, rather than go to the beach and go and get fish, you know, I would go to the library and I'd look up stuff. And it just stayed with me, this story, this pain that my father had carried for so many years just stayed with me. And I tried to write the story about 30 years ago. I started to write it. And, because I was raised in England, I left Jamaica when I was four, I couldn't write it because I didn't know enough about Jamaica, although I knew the facts of the crash by now. And then I wrote Finding Mr. Right, because I'm a handwriting expert, and it was easy to write about what I knew. And so I always tell writers, potential writers, always start with what you know, because writing is a very difficult thing. To be a good writer is a difficult thing, so you start with what you know. So I wrote Finding Mr. Right. It became a bestseller, and that really gave me the confidence to go back to that manuscript that I had already started.
Mm.
So I then decided to move to Jamaica to really get the full grasp, you know, because I was raised in England. I didn't even really speak Patois well.
Oh, wow.
You know? And so when I went to Jamaica, I would just stay on the bus and listen to the intonation. I mean, you were at the embassy when I read.
Yes.
So everything, my aunt read the book and she says, how do you know all these words? How do you know Langalala Lucy? And, you know, it's just like you listen to what people say and I'd be like, oh, God, I know, you know, I could understand it. And I'm like, this is how they would say it. This is how they would make the intonation. And I would just put it straight in the book. You know, I would just put it straight in the book. Whatever I heard, I was like, oh, yeah, this is, I mean, I didn't read it the Thursday night, but I have a character in my book that steals some money.
Okay.
And I couldn't find the pardoner money. You know how important
right.
the pardoner money is. And he stole the pardoner money. And I couldn't find a word that wasn't a swear word to use. And I was sitting on the bus one day, and this woman said, that dundus boy. And I'm like, that is the word. That is the word I need. The dundus boy.
Wow. A writer, Gail, killed us for the right phraseology to communicate.
Exactly. Yeah, and also because I want young people to read it, I want school-age children to read my book, I was trying not to use any profanity, and I was trying, you know, not to... I want them to read the book and understand a part of our history that's been very much hidden these last 52 years.
Wow. It, as I said, I was fortunate to be in attendance when you read this fine work. And,
thank you.
You, apart from the variety of characters you have, and you were able to represent in the reading the different accents, that was marvelous. You should be an actor also. Actress also.
My sister's an actress. I don't want. My mother wasn't allowing the both of us to go down that path.
Okay.
But I think growing up, I learned everything from my sister. I think I learned everything. I have to give my sister props for that.
Oh, this is neat.
I learned everything from my sister. So the thing is, I could go. I mean, when I was writing the book, I mean, sometimes the second excerpt that I read. Sometimes I cry when I read that because I feel that woman's pain, because there's so many women I've known who's been through infidelity with their husbands and gone through so much drama with their husbands. Sometimes when I'm reading that, I want to cry for Eve because she believed in her husband so much, and the whole family told her not to marry this man, and she went and married this man, and then he went and did these horrible things to her. So, because originally when I was writing the book, all my male characters, I didn't want to write a book where the male characters all appeared to be horrible men.
Right.
I grew up with very good role models of men in my family, so I didn't want to disrespect the men in my family. But then what makes a book juicy is when there is some discord.
And
you know, if everybody loves everybody and everybody's nice, nobody wants to read the book.
Right, there has to be a tension point.
Yeah, you know, and also if it was too tragic and too gory, no one would read the book. So I had to mix a lot of that fact of that tragic night with some fiction. My characters are all fictitious. Because the problem I got into trouble with is that people would read my book and then they'd turn to my aunt and say, so which one is you? Which one is your brother? Which one? Your brother really did that thing? You know, so... My aunt would be like, oh, Beverly, you really have created something. But I would say it's good that they feel that these characters are so alive because I've made them all up.
So it took a really... Tell us a little about that. To be a great writer, you have to have a pretty sharp imagination to actually see the character and develop that character and give them that kind of animation.
Well... I suppose so. I don't really know what to say there, but yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think long before I started to write, these characters were developing inside me. You know,
okay. The
more I researched, the more, and then once I decided I was going to write a book, I knew my characters. The only character that what I wasn't quite sure about was Esther. When I went to Jamaica, Eve and Austin were already formulated.
Okay.
And they're components of different people that I know, interesting people that I know. Because your characters have to be vibrant and you've got to be relate. Everybody knows Aunt Pearl. Everybody knows Uncle Dudley. I mean, in every family, no matter how pure and lovely your family be, everybody has one person in that family that jolts your nerves. You know? So
it's very
you
human.
Have to. Yeah, so you have to make it so you can relate. That's your auntie. That's your uncle. That's your brother. You know, I don't have brothers, so I wrote Austin the kind of brother that I would like to have had if I had a brother. Mm. So I created him the way I would have wanted a big brother to protect me and look after me. But Esther, in my book, she was called Patsy. When I arrived in Jamaica, she was called Patsy, and she was the person that I couldn't make her into a character till I got to Jamaica, because I had to get to Jamaica and understand Jamaica more to create her.
Uh-huh.
So once I created her in Jamaica, then I changed her name from Patsy. I knew she couldn't be Patsy anyway. So I gave her a name from the Bible because she was the one that had the faith and the the steadfastness to stay where she was because she knew somebody was coming home. And you would have to believe that. You would have to believe that that night all of you couldn't be dead. Somebody had to come home.
Right.
You know, you had to have that kind of faith to believe that.
I know you're a writer, but just listening to you, is there any thought of turning this into a movie?
Yes, it's in negotiation as we speak.
Wonderful.
I just can't tell you all the details, but it's
okay,
in negotiation.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
We need some good story, and I think it can be, you know, now that we lived in a visual era, I think that can even give some more substance to the book.
Yeah. So I'm also wanting to put the book in audio, because people tell me that I read it. You know, we have a high literacy rate in Jamaica, and I would like to put the book on audio for elderly people and illiterate community.
That would be wonderful.
Some people don't like to read, but I'm sure they would listen to the book.
Well, my job, I have to read eight hours a day, so I listen to a lot of audio books.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah. But, you know, I still have my day job as a handwriting expert, so there's only so much you can do during the course of the day. And when I was living in Jamaica, I was working on 3 radio shows. I was writing 2 columns, and I had a child to raise. And my girlfriend said to me, "When are you writing this book? When do you sleep? Every time I turn around, you're doing something else. When are you writing this book?" I said, "Don't worry about me. The book is being written. Don't worry about me."
In your heart, it does have to get out to the fingertips.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, what are some of the other takeaway messages? You know, the history of Jamaica, you've certainly captured a major event that was not really well documented to that, and you've given it a human sensibility. What are some of the other messages you think readers can take away from this fine work?
Well, first of all, I think in the 21st century, a lot of people, you know, Jamaica has become a brand with Usain Bolt, with our main brands, our Red Stripe beer, our Blue Mountain coffee, all these things have put Jamaica in the forefront internationally. But I think people still just see us as this, and it's not that it's a wrong image, but that we are so much more than reggae and rum and ganja and rasta. You know, we are so much more than that. And I wanted to be able to showcase us. No, I'm not saying that those things that we are negative or bad to be a part of that, but we are so much more than that.
Amen.
Because as soon as you say that we're Jamaican, you know, they think that all of us is Rasta and that we only listen to reggae and, you know what I mean? So I wanted the book to show, because people say, "Oh, I didn't know, you didn't even know Jamaica had a railway track."
Sure.
I didn't even know that we had one of the best engineering railway system in the world, because it was built by the British. We were still part of the British colony. So we had one of the best British railway systems in the world. People don't know that about us.
Don't appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, we've had this terrible incident that's happened in the world, in our country. When I started writing the book, it's still one of the 10 worst human disasters in our country to date.
Wow.
When I started to write it, it was number 5. When I finished it, it was number 8. And when I finished it, two crashes in India had happened, which made it, you know, but it's still in the top 10. We have over 177 people buried in an unmarked grave.
Wow.
You know, I mean, this information still has to be known, and my ultimate goal is to get some kind of fight up, to get some kind of plaque or something.
A memorial.
Yes.
To read.
Yes. There is a plaque in the church that in St. Annes. There is a plaque that's in St. Annes, but I want a plaque at the site.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would like to take the book to the Caribbean, you know, to the, some of the Caribbean islands. I'd like to take the book to Canada, you know, wherever there is a large Jamaican community. And I've had people that are non-Jamaicans, you know, I've had a lot of white Americans or book clubs who are not Jamaicans at all read the book, and, you know, sometimes people just email me and said, I stumbled across your book, I'm not Jamaican. You know, people always buy two books. And this morning I woke up and somebody had gone online my website and bought two books. And people buy two books. They buy one for themselves and they buy one for their mother, or they buy one for, if they're non-Jamaican, they buy another book for a Jamaican person they know.
So this would make a fine gift. Buy one for yourself, buy one for a friend.
Yes.
As a
but
gift.
I
buy one
so
for somebody who may be distant Jamaica. Do you want them to have a keen appreciation of the richness.
Yeah, but I also find, you know, what I've been calling it recently, apart from my peers, I'm in my 50s, but apart from my peers reading the book, what I've found is that my mother's generation love the book. I call it my big people book, because that generation, there are very few books that they can read and relate to. And my book is a book of triumph. My book is a story of struggle. And any immigrant that's been anywhere, traveled anywhere from Jamaica to either come to America, go to Canada, go to England, can relate to my story. And, you know, I've found a lot of people have said, oh, my God, I haven't read the book, but my mom's read the book and she's loved it. My mom has just loved the book. So, you know, it's a big, I call it my big people book. You know, I didn't start out that way, but that's how it's become. And even one of the survivors, the priest, one of the priests that was on the train, his sister, I read the book in Jamaica, his sister sent him a copy to America, where he's living in Virginia.
Okay.
And then one day I got this call from this priest. Well, he's no longer a priest, he's a former priest now. And I was afraid to call him back because I'm thinking, did I offend him? Oh, my goodness, I would hate to think I'm white. And he had this very serious voice. Hello, Miss East, this is Harry Mallette. When you have a moment, could you call me? And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. So I, you know, got Scotch courage, and I called him. And he says, you have done a wonderful job with the minimum information that you must have got from this. And I was there that night, and I felt like I was reliving that night when I was reading it. It was like you were there. It was like you were there. So, and he says, and I know you couldn't have been there because you would have been a little girl and you wouldn't have remembered anything, you know.
Right.
So I went to meet him. I physically got in my car and drove all the way to Winchester and met with him. And he handed over to me, I don't know if you had a chance to see some of the newspaper articles
that you had posted.
Yes. Well, he had given me all the original newspapers from that night.
Wow.
He had kept them. He had kept them for 52 years, and they were just in the box. And he gave them to me.
Incredible.
He gave them to me.
What a treasure.
Yes, so I keep them now in a special box. A librarian came here and she says, you can't keep them in that box. They're going to fade away. And she gave me a special box to preserve them.
So have you
I've
scanned
them?
No,
I haven't scanned them. I've just got them in this box.
Good. I would recommend you scan them, that you have an electronic copy, that it's you have a little more long-term longevity.
Yeah, it's hard to scan them because it's the old-fashioned size paper. It's not the standard, you know,
okay.
I'd have to get a special scanner, you know, a special size scanner, because it's not the standard size that fits on a scanner.
Right, not the 18, 11 by 17 or...
Yeah, it's a big size newspaper size, yeah. And also, I want to mention to you that this tragic accident was on the front page of the New York Times in 1957.
Wow, on the New
York Times.
That's how
big this story was back then.
Hmm.
You know, it was just a pity that, you know, Mr. Tufton was there that night. Originally, I was supposed to have the evening for the entire evening, and then Mr. Tufton came to D.C., and I ended up having to share.
Sure.
So there was no time. There was no time for me to really have any questions and answers. But I still appreciate it. I mean, I thought Mr. Tufton was the right minister to have that evening, because Well, you know, he's young and vibrant.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure we'll have other opportunities. I know of other reading clubs that maybe we can have you at, and for folks to really just hear you share some of that story.
Well, I'd be happy to. Any group of people that you can put me in touch with that you think would be happy to have me come and read to them and speak to them and answer questions, I'm more than happy to do that.
All right. Well, be on the lookout.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So how can people get their hands on this fine work?
Well, I think the easiest thing, because people email me and say they try to get it on Amazon and they're sold out. I think as quickly as they enter the bookstore, it's sold out. So I think the best thing, I always have a stock in my office. So I think the best thing is if they go to my website, which is Write Analysis, WriteAnalysis.com, WriteAnalysis.com, and if they go to publication, because the actual website is obviously about my company as a handwriting expert, but there is a part in the website where you can purchase the book on PayPal, and once I see the payment come up, I will sign the book, and we will send it out to you.
All right. So go to our website, place the order, and it will be out to you. So let's think a little about the future. What's brewing in that fine mind of yours? What can we expect from that in the future?
I laughed when you said fine mind. My mother wouldn't agree that it's a fine mind. She thinks it's a crazy mind. But what's brewing is I'm working on my second novel, third book, and it's an immigration story.
All right.
Yeah, so it's a more contemporary. But it will just have all the twists and turns because that's my style. I think that's how life is. Nothing is just one straight path. We start out on a journey, and somewhere on the journey we end up taking the left fork or the right fork. But we never continue in a straight road because that's not what life is about.
Right. When can we expect that? Do you have any...
Oh, probably 2011 to be realistic.
Okay.
Yeah, 2000, maybe late 2010, but more realistically 2011. Yeah, not unless something happens and I can just spend 6 months knocking it out.
Right.
You know, my goal this year was to finish it, at least the first draft this year, but I'm only halfway through. My work schedule has been really hectic, and I have a young boy that has just gone off to college, so the beginning of this year was just trying to get him into the college that he wanted to be in and go for the interviews, you know, do all that stuff. So
I know, but
now he's gone. Now he's gone. My empty nest, you know, now he's gone. I can get up and write. So I think the first draft may be done by February, and then we have to find, you know, publisher. So I'm saying, early 2011.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that, and I want to thank you so much for sharing yourself with us this morning and for this fine work. And, folks, let's get out and be blessed by this work. Thank you so much, Beverly.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.